I want us to turn over to Philippians 2, if you will, because there's something in it which I think is vital to us, especially during this time of the year, to have a look at. Philippians 2, if you will, the Apostle Paul said something that I think is absolutely enormous value to us if we'll think about it today, and that's what I want us to do. Philippians 2 and verse 14 says this, "Do all things without murmuring and disputing or complaining." And my question today is, why? Why is this so important? In verse 15, it says that you may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God, without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom you shine as lights to the world. Reminds me of a story that I read a while back of a man who, you know, for some years he wanted to be a monk. And he knew it would be a tough life, but he just became obsessed with it. And eventually he went up to a monastery, and he asked the abbot there, he said, "You know, I've been dealing with this for a number of years, and I really think that I want to be a monk." And the abbot said to him, "Well, you know, this is really probably more difficult than you think." And he said, "We have a rule here that you can only speak two words every year, and that's all, just two words." And the man said, "Well, that sounds like a little extreme, but I really want to be a monk, and so, you know, I want to sign up." And so he signed up and became a monk, and they took him to his room, and 12 months passed, and after 12 months, he was ushered into the office of the abbot, and the abbot said, "You can now say your two words." And he said, "Food's bad." And afterwards, he was taken back up to his room, and he spent another 12 months in the monastery there. And after that, he was ushered back up into the abbot's office. And the abbot said, "It's that time again. You can say your two words." And so he said, "Bed's hard." And the abbot said, "I understand, my son, I understand." And he sent him away, and he went back up to his room, and another 12 months went by, and he was asked to come to the abbot's office again, and he came to the office, and the abbot said, "Well, now you can say your two words." And he said, "I quit." And the abbot said, "Well, that doesn't surprise me a bit. All you've done is complain ever since you've been here." You know, the point I'm making today, of course, is that that's what a lot of us do. We've complained ever since we got here. I want you to think about all of this for a minute. Soon as we arrived on earth, we started crying when we were hungry, crying when we needed to be changed, crying when we were unhappy or uncomfortable in any way. Then later on, we went to school, we had complaints about the teachers, we had complaints about homework, we had complaints about the school, you know, we complained about our teachers, we complained about our jobs later when we went to work. We didn't like our bosses, and they did this that we didn't like, they did that that we didn't like, you know. And we've complained about our mates. We don't like this, we don't like that, they do this thing that irritates us. They nag us too much, they expect too much of us around the house, you know. And so it goes. We've been called now into the church of God. And our lives have changed, haven't they? Yes, we no longer have to complain about those things. Now we can complain about the ministers. We can complain about the church. We can have all these things about the church policies that we can complain about. In fact, the church actually seems sometimes like it's a pretty good place for complaining. You know, in the early church, they complained about the Apostle Paul coming into the church. Then they complained because Gentiles were going to be accepted. And you know, it's really not much different in today's world. I remember a long time ago, a man who was a minister in God's church, and he was over our phone line operations, Mr. Richard Rice, perhaps some of you remember him. But it was so interesting. He gave this sermon, and for the life of me, I don't remember the sermon, but I do remember one of his comments. At the end of it, he said, "Now I know what you're all going to do. You're all going to go home this Sabbath and have fried rice." In other words, they were going to fry him. They were going to mock him, make fun of him. They were going to complain about what he did. You know, it's funny. There's another story about a family who went to services on Holy Day, and they were, you know, complaining about the service and everything, and then they had an offering on that Holy Day, and they took up the offering, and the father put in a $10 bill, and then they, after the services, they drove home, and the mother and the father, both parents were just complaining about what the minister did wrong here, what he did wrong there, what he said, he didn't like the way he said this, or didn't like the way he said that. But the kid said, you know, I thought it wasn't a bad show for $10. But you get my point. You get the point. That's what we do. We complain about everything. We have an opinion. I remember Dennis told me once, years ago, he said, Art, you got to learn this. Everyone's a critic. Everyone's their critic, you know. You know, today we apply this word complaining to a lot of different various circumstances, and I want to sort of clarify that today. Have you ever asked this question for yourself? What is it that constitutes complaining? What is it actually that does this? Because it isn't expressing the deep pain that you might feel in your heart to God. You know, the Psalms are full of this kind of mourning and this kind of lament, and God's not against that. There is sorrow in life. And it's not speaking out against danger. It's not speaking out against heresy. And it's not speaking out about injustices that we see. It's not complaining when you see something wrong, even in the church, and you go to someone who can do something about it, and you tell them about it in order to get something changed. That's not wrong. It's not about complaining when you are voicing a problem that's at home that needs to be addressed and offering a solution. That's not wrong. It's not wrong to go to a restaurant and tell the people that you don't care for the entree because something's wrong with it. You know, you're getting something different. You're getting something done about it. But it's wrong to go around and tell everybody in the neighborhood the restaurant stinks, of course. You know, it's not wrong to ask for another choice. It's not wrong to do that. You know, it is wrong to tell or complain about employees in a store and say, oh, they're just all bad over there in that store. You know, but it is not wrong to tell a manager that one of the employees is doing something that's offensive. It's not wrong. It's not wrong to complain about something by returning defective materials. That isn't complaining, you know. And it is wrong to badmouth different various churches. It really is wrong to do that. Not wrong to talk to someone in the church that can correct the problem. You know, it's really wrong when we complain and don't do anything to correct the problem or fix it. And that's the kind of complaint that God is highly dissatisfied with. And that's the kind of complaint that can actually eat at us and hurt us spiritually over time. Telling others bad things without doing anything about it. And this becomes a kind of self-centered discontent. And it starts with a murmuring that is in our mind, and then we vocalize that to others. You know, there's other times where we just roll our eyes, you know, or sometimes we'll go off in a huff, or sometimes we'll just send body language, you know, to people that shows our discontent, but it's still our way of complaining. And I want you to think about this, about God. There were numerous times that he was dissatisfied with the behavior of Israel, but you never, ever hear him just complain. God did something about it every time. He would give them chances. He would tell them where their wrong was, but then he would do something if it didn't change. And so complaining that God is concerned about in us is very specific, and it's limited to this. Complaining when it's really not wrong, and also complaining when we don't do anything to correct it. However, I want you to think about this. This is the culture that you and I live in today, and people are feeling more and more powerless to do anything about the conditions they live in. And so what they do is they complain. They don't have very much positive to say. I want you to think for a minute. Just think about the internet today. You know, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong has been dead for almost a quarter of a century, and you know there are websites that are dedicated singly to complaining about him. Yes. And there are sites that are complaining about other sites, and sites that are complaining about other churches. And it's going all over the world, you know? It's so funny. Today I get emails over and over every day that tell me about the government and how bad it is. And it's interesting to me that I know some of them are to help inform. I know they're motivated by that. But so many of them are just complaining about the government. And so they send the email to me, and then they ask me at the end of the email to send this to as many people as I can, and we have complaints going all around the world, millions a day. Complaints. And nobody's doing much about it. You know, have you read the, part of the paper where people have an opinion section? You know, you read there, and over, people are complaining about this government official, complaining about this act of management, complaining about this bill, complaining, and you hardly ever see a solution there. I mean, hang around the water cooler at work sometime. Hang around there. What do you hear? Complaints about the boss, complaints about the management, complaints about how much money they make, you know. You know, it is wrong to constantly whine about something that isn't in itself wrong. For example, you're at the water cooler and people are talking about they aren't getting paid enough, you know. They aren't getting paid enough. You know, but think about it. How many of us actually have enough to get along with? We're getting paid what the average person who works in that job gets paid. We're getting along with what we have, and that's about what people get paid. You know, if a person wants a raise, if they want to get more money, there's lots of things you can do about it. You can study more about your specific job. You can work harder than everybody else. You can be the very best that you can be. And if that doesn't work, you have the right to go look for another job. What you don't have a right to do is constantly complain to other people. But we've become a world of complainers. You know, some people think that they are treated unjustly, and they think somehow that the world owes them a living and that they deserve more. You know, all of this works on us in our society, and it eats at us in various ways. And one of those ways is it causes enormous stress on everybody. It can hurt your health. It really can if you let something like this get a hold of you or if you feed into it. And so, you know, after the days of Thanksgiving that we celebrated, I want to come back with this and talk about how complaining can hurt us. The Midwest Center for Stress Control did a study on negativity, and it was kind of interesting. They said that the average person in today's society has 300 negative thoughts every day. 300 negative thoughts every day. I think that's 1 every 2.5 minutes, a negative thought. And they said this as they wrote about their study. Feelings like anger, insecurity, anxiety, and jealousy not only trigger aches and pains or digestive problems in the body, but they can also lead to chronic disease conditions and even a shorter lifespan. Negative and hostile feelings are associated with increases in adrenaline and cortisol, high blood pressure, heart palpitations, higher cholesterol levels, and alterations in our personal immune system. 300 negative thoughts a day. That's the average. 1 every 2.5 minutes. It's happening over and over again. You know, it's interesting that last week I was reading Fox News, and they had a press release from the Associated Press, and it read this, that they read about a study of the result of negative attitudes, and they said, the government says 1 in 5 American adults suffers from mental illness, and they did so during the past year. Most, however, did not receive treatment. A survey being released Thursday by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration found that 45 million experienced some form of mental illness in 2009. And you know what it was from? Depression. Because those negative thoughts add up. It was from depression, and many had it lead to suicide attempts. Because you can only take so much negativity until life doesn't seem like it's worth living anymore. So today, I'm asking you to consider this in your life. Because most of those negative thoughts that we think, most of them end up in us complaining one way or another. And so obviously it's not good for our physical health. But of course my issue today is more important than that. Hebrews 12, if you will, Hebrews 12. My issue today is our spiritual health. What does complaining accomplish for us and for the kingdom of God that we seek? What does it do? Is it any help to it? Or could it be that it's a tremendous hindrance to that which we pursue? What does it do to ourselves and others? Why is it a problem? Here's the reason. When we start getting negative, when we start complaining, then we're beginning to crack that door and to open the door that leads to bitterness. And often, the people who are the most bitter are the ones you hear complaining the most. And I say today, it does. It can and it does have a tremendous effect on our attitude. And for this reason, the scriptures warn us of this. In Hebrews 12 and verse 14, follow peace, it says, with all men, and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord, looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God. How can we fail of the grace of God? Lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled. Romans 8. Have you ever thought about that, that complaining could lead to you being defiled before God? Romans 8. A wrong approach to life can lead to defiling the mind, even of God's people, and it can lead us to being more negative about everything in general in our life. And you know what else? It makes you difficult to be around. Complaining actually does something of enormous importance to us. I want you to think about this. Complaining negates God's sovereignty in our lives. As the Apostle Paul wrote in Romans 8 and verse 28, and he said this, we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to those who are called according to our purpose. Well, my question is, do we really know that? For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren, that we might be born with him. Moreover, who he did predestinate, them he also called. And whom he called, he also glorified. And whom he justified, them he also glorified. What shall we say then to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He that spared not his own Son, but delivered him up for us, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things? Do we believe that, that he will care for us, whatever our needs might be? And then he says, who shall lay anything to the charge of God's elect? It's God that justifies. Who is he that condemns? It is Christ that died, yes, rather that's risen again, that is even at the right hand of God, who also makes intercession for us. So somebody complains about us? Well, he's on our side, defending us. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation, distress, or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or peril, or sword? In other words, nothing can separate us from him except us, if we choose to. As it's written, For your sake, we're killed all the day long. We're accounted as sheep for the slaughter. And yet we don't want to take the slightest injury to our ego. We don't want to take any complaint against us. Nay, in all these things, he says, we're more than conquerors through him that loved us. And I'm persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, or height, or depth, or any other creature can separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus, our Lord. We know all things work together for our good. We know that we've been a part of God's plan from the very beginning. We've been a part of it. We know how much Jesus Christ has invested in us and God the Father by coming here and dying and giving his life. We know he's got a plan that's very important for us. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 10. And yet, if we're complaining, we're acting very much as if God is unconcerned, that he doesn't care, he's uninvolved. But I'm telling you, in every situation in our life, as he says, even the hairs of our head are even numbered, you know, and everything, good or anything that we may think is bad that happens to us, is good for us if we will learn the lesson from it, because there is a lesson in every single circumstance we have. And when you think about it, God is in complete control. There are spiraling galaxies going out at millions of miles an hour, and the earth is going around the sun, and the earth is rotating, and he knows right where you're sitting right now. He knows exactly what you're doing. That's the kind of God we worship, and that's the kind of God that loves us and has a plan for us. And what in the world can these small things that seem to bother us so much and make us complain and turn us negative, how can they affect any of this? They can't. We should be overwhelmed by what God is doing with us when you think about it. And when you do think about it, you have to remember that God himself promises, hey, you may be going through a tough time, but you're not going through anything that I know you can't take, and I will make a way of escape. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13 says this, but we will not, I'm sorry, I'm in 2 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 10:13. There has no temptation taken you, but such as common to man, it says. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above what you're able, but will with the temptation also make a way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. So God's going to make a way of escape, but he isn't going to make a way of escape so that you can get out of the problem. He's going to make a way of escape so that you can bear it. He's going to take you through it, and he won't put too much pressure on us so that we'll break. But we have to go through things in life, good things and bad things, so that we understand what life is like, because we're going to be helping others. And so we have to understand so that we'll have compassion, and that's why Christ suffered. And so we learn in every circumstance, whether it's a good one we think is good or positive, and sometimes those can be a trap, or whether we think it's negative. There are lessons for us to learn in all of those things. And still, in all of this, in spite of it, we still think we have a reason to complain about things. You know, we were given the land of Israel. And the Israelites have a very colorful history of complaining, if you think about it. You know, the people of God complained about their slavery. And then God sent them a deliverer, Moses. Moses complained that he didn't have the ability to speak very well. So God said, okay, I'll give you Aaron then. You know, then finally Israel is saved, and they're leaving Egypt behind, and then they're confronted with the Red Sea. Now they're complaining again. Now they're delivered a couple hours later, and the next thing you know, they are complaining there's no water. It was just one complaint after another complaint after another. And the reason I bring them up is because Israel was recorded, their history was recorded for us who would live at the end of the age. They murmured when they wanted water. They murmured when they wanted flesh to eat. They complained and wanted to return to Egypt, you know. You know, they never thought about how much God provided them. Now, I want you to think, there had to be 200 million people. I mean, 2 million people. There were 600,000 men of war, and so that would have probably been with women and children about 2 million people. Now, he gave each one of them an omer of manna every day. Now, I want you to start putting this into its context. That's like 12 million pints of manna every day. You know, he gave them 9,000 pounds or 4,500 tons of manna every day. You could have 10 trains, each one having 30 boxcars behind it to feed them, and he gave it every day. And that's what he gave them, you know. And that's what God is willing to do to protect and provide and take care of his people. And what are we thinking when we think that we haven't got enough? When we start to complain about our circumstances? Don't you see what I'm saying? We're doubting the sovereignty of God, aren't we? We are, if you think about it. Look at Numbers 13. Numbers 13. We'll go back to some of their history today. They complained about the leadership of Moses. Remember, Korah got a band together and contested his leadership, and then God opened the ground and swallowed them. And for what? Complaining. That's what he did. Okay, Numbers 13. Finally, they arrive at the promised land. Finally, they get there, and they send spies into the land. They bring back these massive clusters of grapes, magnificent pomegranates, and the people are awed by it, you know, but they couldn't find a reason to stop complaining. They had to keep complaining. Numbers 13 and verse 27. Numbers 13, verse 27. Here's what they said. They told him, and they said, "We've come into the land whither you sent us, and surely it flows with milk and honey." And this, they said, showing them the pomegranates and the grapes and everything, "This is the fruit. Nevertheless, the people be strong that dwell in the land. And the cities are walled and very great. Moreover, we saw the children of Anak there. And the Amalekites dwell in the land of the south, and the Hittites and Jebusites and Amorites dwell in the mountains. And the Canaanites dwell by the sea and by the coast of Jordan." And Caleb stilled the people before Moses, and he said, "Let us go up at once and possess it, for we're well able to overcome it." But the men that went up with him said, "We be not able to go up against it. The people, they're much stronger than we are." And they brought up an evil report of the land which they had searched unto the children of Israel, saying, "The land which we have gone to search is a land that eats up its inhabitants. And all the people that we saw are in it are men of great stature. And there we saw giants, the son of Anak, which came of the giants. And we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, and so were we in their sight." Well, does anybody come up against giants today? A loss of a job, an injury, a health problem of some kind, a tax issue? Every one of us comes up against our giants today, and we go, "Oh no, what are we going to do?" And yet God does somehow and has brought us through everything to this very day. And he's going to bring us through everything that we have to face. You know, it would be natural, it would, to have some sort of fear, I think, seeing these people. You know, but how quickly we forget the miracles that God has shown us in our lives and in their lives. And what happens is the complaining becomes like a cancer. That is, it's like leaven. It just begins to eat things and spread as it grows and grows more and more. And that's one of the biggest problems about complaining, is it becomes contagious and you can infect other people with it. And that's what makes it so bad to me. Those spies, they infected the entire camp in time. And all the people began to complain. Look over here in chapter 14. And all the congregation, they lifted up their voice, and they cried and wept all that night. And the children of Israel murmured against Moses. That means complained. That's what they did. They complained. And against Aaron, and the whole congregation said unto them, "Would God that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would God we had died in the wilderness." Boy, we wish we would have died rather than have to face this. "Wherefore has the Lord brought us into this land to fall by the sword, and that our wives and children should be prey? Were it not better for us to return to Egypt?" They wanted to return back to Egypt. How soon we forget. And they said to one another, let us make a captain, and let us return to Egypt. And then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, which were before them that searched the land, they rent their clothes. They just couldn't believe it. And they spoke unto all the company of the children of Israel, saying, the land which we pass through to search it is exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, and then he'll bring us into this land and give it to us, a land that flows with milk and honey. And I say this, you got problems. I know you do. I have problems. But if the Lord delights in us, you understand? If we're doing what he wants, living the way we should, he's going to delight in us and take delight in us. And he's going to make sure that we get what we want. We're going to be in that kingdom. And he says this, he calls it rebellion. Don't rebel against the Lord. Neither fear you, the people of the land. They're just bread for us. And the defenses parted, departed from them. And the Lord is with us. Fear them not. And all the congregation bade stone them with stones. And the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle of the congregation before all the children of Israel. And the Lord had to stick up for his leaders. And the Lord said unto Moses, how long will this people provoke me? How long will it be ere they believe me for all the signs which I've shown them? And so it is. The people would not believe them. So hold your place there. Stick something in there, Numbers, because we're going to come back to it. But I want to go to Ecclesiastes 7 just for a moment and pick something up there. Ecclesiastes 7. You know, the people thought that they actually had it better in Egypt. You know, and God tells us something of great importance. He says, don't dwell on the past thinking it was better. Don't make stupid, foolish comparisons like this. And he says it for a reason. In verse 10, say not what is the cause that the former days were better than these, for you do not inquire wisely concerning this. And that is a very good piece of advice. You know why? Because our mind does something. Our perception is almost always faulty. Our perception tends to exaggerate the past, and that's what Israel did. They inflated their memory regarding Egypt, and they thought about the flesh pots, and they thought about all the good food they had to eat there, you know? But it wasn't a true perspective, was it? It wasn't even close. It totally forgot the fact that there were taskmasters that had a whip, a lash at their back. They forgot the back-breaking work. And that's what we do. We look backwards and we think, well, I remember these good things. And we don't remember the bad things then. And now we want to compare it to what we're doing now. And God says, it's not wise. Don't do it. Because it's just going to lead to complaining. That's what it's going to do. Embellishing the past. Thinking it was better than it is now. And so we complain about today. Well, back to Numbers 11. Because here's the point. Numbers 11, verse 1. When the people complained, it displeased the Lord. The Lord heard it, and his anger was kindled. And the fire of the Lord burnt among them and consumed them, that were in the uttermost parts of the camp. And so look, complaining eventually caused them to lose out on the promised land. And I'm saying today, in all honesty, is it possible that our complaining is a lack of faith? As you remember, God said, will I find faith on the earth when I return? And so is it possible that our complaining could keep us from the kingdom of God? That's my issue today. Every time we start to complain, I see it. It's a test. It really is a test of God's sovereignty in our lives. Do we believe he is in control? And do we believe that his provision is enough? Because when we complain, we're taking our eyes off God, aren't we? And we're putting them on the thing we want. So what is really happening here? You know, we're accusing God, in a sense, of being a bad provider, of being a bad father, if we're complaining. If we are not trusting in his provision. Let's go to 2 Corinthians 10 this time. It's ironic that we know these stories, and we know them by heart. You know, we've heard them so many times that we know the stories, and yet sometimes we act as though we don't know the stories, like we're unfamiliar, haven't heard that before. And so we find ourselves open to this malaise of complaining, and we don't fully trust God to take care of us when we do this, is what we're really saying. And what I think is worse than that is that we are not rejoicing in those things he has given us. You understand my point? If we're looking at what we don't have, we can't possibly see all we do have. And that's what the Israelites did. They were looking at what they were afraid of. They weren't looking at the miracles and the times that God saved them in their recent history. And that's the problem. And so what we do is we're comparing ourselves generally with somebody else. We're looking at what they have, and we're saying, well, I don't have it. I'd like to have what they have. And so what's going on here? What's really taking place? Is it lust? Is it envy? What is it that's driving us? But 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 12, Paul makes this point. We dare not make ourselves of the number or compare ourselves with some that commend themselves. But they measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves, they are not wise. Man, that is such a true statement. That is so unwise to compare ourselves against other people. And here's the reason. There's always somebody smarter. There's always somebody richer. There's always somebody better looking. There always is somebody that's got it better than us. But what we don't think about, again, just like those Israelites, we don't think about, well, where did it come from? What was it like before? We don't know what they struggled through. We don't know how many times they failed before they finally succeeded. We don't know how hard they were willing to try, much harder than us perhaps. You know, you understand, we don't see the whole picture. And so it's just foolishness on our part to compare ourselves with other people. And we don't know the future, and we don't know what they're going to lose. And I know there's a scripture, I think, in Psalm 73 where David said, I almost blew it, because I compared myself with those that were wicked and seemed to have plenty. And then I realized there isn't anything planned for them. It all comes to nothing. They have to start over again, you know? And that's what we should think about. We try to compare ourselves with others. How foolish this is that I'm to compare myself with one single person. And that's Jesus Christ. And that is what matters. Things don't matter. Materialism doesn't matter. Pain and suffering doesn't matter. We could have riches and it's a trial, and we can have poverty and it's a trial. It's always a trial. And the issue is building character, and the issue is what is eternal, not what is temporary and what's on this earth. And that is a mighty, important truth. Just foolish to complain about our circumstances. Proverbs, if you will, 30. Proverbs 30. You know, but it's unfortunately, or I guess fortunately from God's point of view, because he designed it this way, that we have human nature, and our human nature is never satisfied. Now, I remember the scripture in Ecclesiastes where it says the ear isn't filled with hearing or the eyes with seeing. We're just never like the rivers. They all empty into the sea, you know, and yet the sea's never full. never fills up and covers all the continents, yet all the rivers are constantly emptying into it. And that's how we are. We're just never satisfied. We never have enough. We always want more. But that can be its own trap for us. And so we've got to recognize this is a part of our human nature. We've got to recognize that this is a dangerous part of it. And we should be warned by God, by these verses, here in Proverbs 30 and verse 8. Remove far from me vanity, he says, and lies. Give me neither poverty nor riches, but feed me with food convenient for me. He says for a reason, lest I be full and deny you. And that's what happens, doesn't it? The rich people, I remember we had this Plain Truth Blitz program, and we went and put the Plain Truth out in different places, and all the wealthy neighborhoods, they never took the magazine. All the poor neighborhoods, they knew they needed help, and they would take it. So you don't want, you think you want riches, you think it would be great to win the lottery, but it might be the test you can't pass. It might be the thing that would destroy you. What if I ask, who's the Lord? Lest I be proud or something, or hungry and steal and take the name of God in vain. And so there's a reason for this. Not looking one way or the other. Not wanting one or the other. Just accepting our fate, trying to do the best we can, and trying to live God's way. That's the important thing in life. However, as I said, it's the human condition. It's human nature. It's the way it is. We seek pleasure and not pain. We seek pleasure and not adversity, and we seek prosperity, and that's the way it is. And so we complain when we don't get what we want often. Then when the unexpected happens, we often say, why me, Lord? You know, the TV goes on the blink, why me, Lord? You know, the mower doesn't work, we need to get it fixed. You know, the dishwasher broke down, I have to get it fixed. And we think, oh, woe is me, and oh, I'm not ready for this, and it's just another trial. But here's the truth of the matter. What we should be thinking is how grateful we are that we have a TV, how grateful we are that we have a lawnmower, how grateful we are that we have a dishwasher. And I remember an email that somebody sent me, I think it was Dennis's sister, who sent this picture of a Marine over in Afghanistan. And he had had his wife send him a plot of grass. And he had these little stones out there in a square that was probably about 7 or 8 feet by 2 feet. And he had planted grass there in the middle of the desert, and he went and he clipped it with scissors, and he took such immaculate care because he cared about having just a piece of grass in this horrible nightmare of a place he was living. But he was making the best of things, and we complain if the mower breaks, not even thinking I've got a lawn, a beautiful lawn and a nice house, and I've got all this that I take for granted. And that's my point today. You can see it after experiencing Thanksgiving. How thankful are we? Or do we still find it necessary to complain from time to time? You know, when we do, it's envy at work and it's lust at work. You know, and when we're tempted to murmur, when we're tempted to complain, then we are on the wrong side of the fence. We need to be counting our blessings and seeing what's on the other side instead. I want us to think for a minute as we go to 2 Peter about our Savior. We are to walk as He walked. We are to follow His example and live as He lived to the best of our ability. Let's go to 2 Peter 2 for a minute, because I want you to consider the example He left for us to walk in. As it says, He was misunderstood by His family members. No complaint. His disciples argued over who was going to be the greatest in the kingdom. No complaint on His part. The Pharisees questioned His authority. What right do you have to teach this? They were constantly trying to trap Him. They were always after Him, all the time. No complaint. You never hear Him complain. Peter denies Him 3 times. No complaint. He's nailed to a stake. He's beaten beyond recognition. He can look down and see his ribs. No complaint. You don't hear a complaint from Him. When they hurled insults at Him, there was no complaint. 1 Peter 2. Verse 19, for this is thankworthy, it says, if a man for conscience towards God endures grief, suffering wrongfully. For what glory is it when you're buffeted for your faults? You shall take it patiently. But if you do well and suffer for it, then you take it patiently. This is acceptable to God. That's the example that he left for us. That's the example that we are to be following in our lives. And complaining isn't a part of it. Philippians 4. For another interesting scripture on this, Paul also did not complain. He said that we were to follow him as he followed Christ. And he says here in verse 11 of chapter 4, not that I speak in respect of want, for I've learned in whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content. That's my whole point. That's my whole point of my message today, is if God is in control, and if we're doing our best to live his way of life and to do things right in this life, why aren't we content? We should be content with what we have. We should trust God in it. And I think it's really important to realize that when Paul was denouncing complaining in this very statement I just read, he was shackled in jail. That's what he was doing. He was in jail, in prison. And he could have had a right to complain, some would think. But he didn't think so. He thought it was not legitimate. He didn't see himself as the prisoner of Rome. He saw himself as the prisoner of the Lord. And that's what he called himself, didn't he? Because he knew God was in control. So why complain? Instead of complaining, what did he do? Preach the gospel. Because he thought God must have put me here because he wanted the gospel preached here. And so he wrote letters, and he had time to do some of those things that he needed to do to take care of the churches from there. It's like he had his own private office. It just depends on how you look at things. That's my point. You know, it's a matter of perspective sometimes. And that reminds me of a story about a man who was a cowboy. And over in Wyoming, and he was driving his truck kind of pretty fast on the road that day, and he had his faithful dog in the back seat of the truck, and he had a trailer, and he was bringing his horse that was, well, he felt, one of his best friends, and very loyal to him. His horse was being pulled in a trailer behind. Well, he was speeding, tried to negotiate a turn, and he couldn't make it. So he goes into this terrible wreck. Well, a few minutes later, a highway patrolman came up, and he saw this dog whimpering, suffering in pain, and the officer just couldn't stand it, so he pulled out his revolver and ended the dog's misery. Bang. And then he goes over a little further, and he sees this horse that is just mangled and just suffering terribly, and he just can't take it. His stomach is turned, and he pulls his gun out, and he shoots him. And then he walks over and a little bit more, and he sees the cowboy, and he's over there with multiple fractures laying on the ground in pain. And he says, "Are you okay?" And the cowboy says, "Never felt better," as he looked into the barrel of the gun smoking. Never felt better. You know, it's always a matter of perspective, isn't it, in our lives? If you look at it the right way, if you look at it God's way, you're going to see that all of us are blessed enormously and will be blessed even more than we could ever imagine. Now, I have a quote from George Bernard Shaw that I want you to listen to carefully, very carefully, and I want you to think about it now. He writes, "This is the true joy in life, being used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one. Being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy. I'm of the opinion that my life belongs to the whole community, and as long as I live, it's my privilege to do for it what I can. It's sort of a splendid torch which I've got a hold of for one moment, and I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations." Wow. That's what I say to that statement. Wow. this is more true for us than it even comes close to being true for him. You and I are being used for a transcendent goal that is a purpose beyond what any man could ever imagine. We're called to be the first to trust in God, and our job is going to be to help bring the rest of mankind into God's family. You know, think about that for a minute. Our lives belong to God. As such, our lives also belong to his future children. You and I have been given a privilege greater than anyone could ever dream of, and we carry the light of God inside us, and our desire should be one thing, and that is this, that we carry that light as brightly as we can through our lives, and we don't do that by complaining and griping and moaning and groaning about our condition. What does that say about our relationship with God? I think Bernard Shaw really has a point here that we should learn from. We have a purpose that's of enormous importance. You and I have a purpose in life. We have a direction. We have a goal, and it's transcendent. And God has given us his own spirit. And with that spirit, you and I have been given the eyes to understand why things are the way they are. We have the eyes and the mind to be able to understand the purpose of life. We can understand the scriptures, and we're going to one day be in New Jerusalem. One day eat and drink at Christ's table. One day be majestic and glorious and radiate resplendent beauty. That's what we have to look forward to, not a raise in pay. How come we're complaining? What are we thinking of? 1 Thessalonians 5. There is another reason for not complaining, and it's simply this. It's God's will that we don't do so. He has a will for us, and the will is that we be filled with gratitude. 1 Thessalonians 5:18, where it says this, in everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus concerning you. Now, I don't know how many times I've heard the brethren ask, I wish I knew God's will. I wish I knew God's will. Well, now you know God's will for you. Be filled with gratitude. That's his will. It is the only real and the only lasting antidote for complaining that I know of. To be thankful, you know, to have an attitude of gratitude. And this is the way that God works. And he says this in Romans through the Apostle Paul. That's the principle of replacement. You replace evil with good. Replace complaining with gratitude. And that is the way to solve our human problem of dissatisfaction with the way things are. You know, not griping and complaining. We're to be lights in the world. A light to other people's to see. Instead, what's happening to some is we're letting the world mold us. We're letting the world shape us into what it is. And everybody's unhappy, trust me. You know, we just finished Thanksgiving and you go into Christmas. I suggest to anybody who wants to, go on a stand on a corner and watch the faces of the people in the cars as they go by. And you're not going to see joy to the world. You're going to see unhappiness. People arguing, people mad, people honking, screaming at each other. You can't get the parking place to Sears and Roebuck. You know, that's what you're going to see out there. 2 Corinthians. The good news is this. We can change our attitude. 2 Corinthians 10, for a very famous verse here. It starts with a conscious effort to change. We can change. You can change. All of us can, because God's given us a mind and the ability to make choices, and we can choose what kind of attitude we're going to have. We can set our attitude. 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 5 says this, we're to cast down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Yes, that's what we are supposed to do. The heroes of faith all down through history, they suffered. They did not complain. They took action and took their problems to God. And we've got to learn to do what they did. We've got to look at our blessings. Look at the miracles he has performed in our lives. Look at the good things that we do have. And to me, there's a famous story that illustrates this very, very well. There was a man traveling through Africa, and he was walking along a path with some of the natives who were helping guide him, and suddenly one of the natives, without him realizing, shot a snake that was right in front of him, and the man thought, man, I'm in danger here, you know. I could have stepped right on that snake. And he wondered to himself, how could he see it, you know? I'm walking on the same path he's walking on. Anyway, he said to the guy, you know, I'm amazed at this, that you saw that snake. I'm sure glad you didn't, you know, that you did see it. And he kept walking after a while, and the native stops him and holds him back and says, see that? See, that's a leopard. And the guy goes, I can't believe this, you know. You see a snake, I see a path. You know, I see shadows and rocks, you see a leopard. How is it? Why are you able to see it and I'm not able to? And the native looked at him and he said, you have to have bush eyes. You understand? Once you've been in the jungle long enough, you begin to see things the way they really are. But it takes training to be able to have bush eyes. Well, look, you and I need to have God eyes. It takes some training, yes. But it takes training our mind to be able to see what's around us and to see what we have and to see how blessed we are. And if we develop God eyes like that, we're not going to be complainers, mumblers, and gripers, and groaners like those Israelites were. We'll read their lessons and we'll learn from them because we are those people who live at the end of the age, and we're going to learn from those examples.